Hi, you're listening to the second series of Rainbow Turtle Rebooted, the podcast brought to you by Rainbow Turtle, the fair trade shop and charity based in Paisley in the west of Scotland. We will bring you the stories from the campaigners and products that show how Scotland supports and benefits from fair trade farmers and producers across the world. Welcome back. I'm so glad you've joined us for part two of the John Riches interview. If you've not heard it, do check out part one, where John talks about his early life and influences. In part two, we join John where he talks about setting up the Balmore Trust and the Coach House, instruments that we used to generate funds for overseas projects. Very quickly, they got involved in buying products from people in small communities in Asia, when they realised it was better to do that than to give them grants. From there, it was a small jump to getting involved in fair trade, where it's about supporting the farmers and producers, which then benefits their families and creates stable communities. He's had about 40 years working in fair trade. That includes setting up JTS, that it got involved in the Scotland-Malawi partnership and buying and importing rice from small farmers in a landlocked country. For a farmer, selling 90 kilograms of rice would allow them to send a child to school for a year. He has a lot of insights into fair trade, and I'm sure you'll enjoy this episode as much as I did.
When I was looking at the history of the business, it seemed that on Companies House anyway, it started in 1980.
Right.
So was it going before then? Did you have something going here before then?
No, I mean, when we bought the house, which was 72, just at the end of 72, we moved in. So we're here just over 50 years now. The Sheena Adamson had a little craft shop in here. And so they'd done the place up and they got planning permissions. And which was very fortunate because by this time we opened, we wouldn't have passed because of dimensions and fire escapes and things like that. They were looking to sell the house with a going business. And nobody was interested, quite rightly. I mean, I don't think the business was a hobby. That was probably it. So when we came up to look, they just put it back on the market and we bought the house. We had it for all sorts of purposes. I mean, it was very cold and we only used it in the sort of spring, summer. And I wrote a book up here and we had, I was doing work with St. George's Mary Hill and we had their youth group out here and had church meetings here and then we decided to open up this shop. So it had been a shop and they'd done it up, including the creaky staircase and all the beams that were across here. I mean, we had to replace the roof when we were doing this. So the main timber was cracked. So all this is new. It was relatively easy to move into.
Yes.
I had to shelve it out. I mean, we never spent money on shelving or anything like that. We just, whatever we could cobble together, really. Yeah, I think every year we closed after Christmas. I mean, we had small kids, and this was very intrusive, really. And Nana said, you know, I'm not doing this unless we have 3 months on, you know, for ourselves. So we closed from 1st of January to 1st of April.
I remember your sales here would, you know, just after Christmas, and we'd sort of dive down here to sort of
get all the
before
goodness.
You close.
Yeah.
So did the shop open in 1980, or did you have something running before that?
The way it started, really, we were out in South Africa in 75, went to the Transkei, and then I was working as a doctor. And that was apartheid. They were dumping people in the Transkei. I mean, the conditions were terrible. It was something like 25%.
What year would that have been?
Well, the first time we went was 75.
Right, OK.
Yeah, there was 25% TB in that country, in the Transkei. And huge poverty. And the hospital was full of people with kwashiorkor and kids who were undernourished. So that gave us quite a shock. And then the Church of Scotland had some programme where they're encouraging people to get into small groups and sort of think a bit what they should be doing. So we'd been reading Ronald Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Poverty, or something like that, with a group of friends here, and feeling very guilty about how rich we were and how little we were doing about it. And then we went again in 79, we went out to the Transcar. When we came back, Jan Brown, who was a friend of us, said, why don't we start up a shop? The first idea had been we would just have an Oxfam shop here. And I went to Oxfam and they said, no, they weren't the least bit interested in a shop out here. We couldn't get enough turnover from that. We said, OK, we'll do it ourselves. I then went to Oxfam and they were immensely helpful. And they gave us their kind of constitution. I mean, they had Oxfam and Oxfam Trading, and the Oxfam Trading covenanted all their profits to Oxfam, and we used that model. So they were helpful with setting the business up. So we opened on the 15th of May, I think, during Christian Aid Week.
1980,
yes. And none of us had ever run a shop. And, I mean, we'd spent hours in our sitting room planning this thing. But I don't think any of us really believed it would work. So when we opened, we had sort of teas and coffees outside and we were serving them out of our kitchen. And then on the next Tuesday when we opened, there were people there who wanted coffee and we hadn't really thought about that. Uh-huh. So running backwards and forwards to the house with pans of hot milk and things. So, but we had absolutely no costs. You know, we owned the place, but it was all volunteers. And I'd asked people to tell me, you know, if they were prepared to give me a loan. And I'd had money for loans up to about 1,500, I think, which was quite a lot of money in those days. So we placed orders for stock, and we'd been all the way to Fort William to get. There was a liquidation sale for Mary Hedwick's card business, Coal. And we filled the car up with this stuff. They were the most beautiful cards. So we had tons of that. I mean, half of one of our bedrooms was full of it. And we'd paid $250 for that. We had to pay that. But that was the only capital we put in, because by the end of the first month, we'd taken enough to pay our bills. Mm-hmm. So, you know, within a month, we were established as a business. I mean, it was still, I was very nervous about it. How would we do the publicity? How would we get people in here? Because, you know, but we were the only place you could get a coffee in those days. I mean, now that get coffees everywhere. But people who wanted to sort of wee run out would come in. And on a Sunday, there would be cars parked from, you know, the corner on the road there, so as far as you could see around our little road. So, and it was really quite full in here. So I think by the autumn, we'd had an article in the Scottish Field, and that brought people in. Mm. And we had very good support from the Nogai Herald. We were making a profit from the first year. And then after a while, I mean, we were making a lot of money. And we'd set it up initially just to raise funds for our trust. You know, and I think one of our first grants was for some ponies for the staff at a hospital in Lesotho so they could get to their clinics. Because the roads there, we subsequently worked in that hospital, and the roads were very exciting. And periodically there'd be a landslip and the road would go. So ponies were a good thing. By the end of the first year, we were actually giving money away. And then for a long time, I guess, we gave probably raised £20,000 or £30,000 a year in profits. But we were all volunteers. I mean, Jan Brown was our manager for 9 years, and you couldn't wish for a better manager and salesperson, but that was all voluntary. So, you know, we had no overhead, so very easy to make a profit.
And were you selling fair trade products then, or was it just...
No, we weren't. I mean, we for the first 2 years, I would say, Tradecraft were just starting. I mean, they'd started in 79. They were coming around with a little catalogue, which was very brown, really. They were selling seekers baskets and from Bangladesh. So we did have seeker baskets, and we sold those. We had goods from Oxfam and from Oxfam Trading, so it was their imports. And we also had goods from Camp Hill villagers who work with handicapped people and made very nice things. Our initial intention was to raise money for a trust. And then, after about 2.5 years, Willie Slaven, who was...
Oh, I know Willie.
Yeah, Willie was a wonderful Catholic, rebellious priest, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Willie had been out in Bangladesh, and he turned up here one Sunday afternoon with Angela Gomez. He'd met out there, obviously. Uh-huh. And she was middle-class Catholic Bangladeshi, who, when she'd left school, had sort of disguised herself as a Muslim and gone and worked with women who'd been raped during the Civil War and were living on the street and doing domestic work for £1 a month or something. Mm. And she'd organised them all into small groups. You know, so they would, when they'd bought rice from the market, they'd put a handful in their kitty, and then they'd buy from that, and then they could get a few chickens, and then they could make some money out of the eggs, and then eventually get enough for a fish pond, and then they could release somebody to do handicrafts. And so she was wanting to sell these handicrafts. And I said to her, look, we've got a trust, we could, if you wanted a grant or something. And she said, no, I don't want your money. I want you to buy our women's goods, because that's what gives them their dignity. And, I mean, she described how, you know, these women were totally shamed. They'd been raped and they were sort of discarded, and they felt worthless. Mm. And doing the crafts, the crafts were done by Kumitini, I think it was, which was quite a big organisation. Mm. And Joya Potier, who was ran that, also came into the coach house. And she was saying, you know, you would see these women, and when the first time that they'd get the materials from Kumitini, and then they'd do it, and then they'd come with their husbands, walking behind their husbands, to the factory, to Kumadini, to sell their crafts and get the money. And the second time, you know, the husband realised his wife was making money and had to be treated, didn't necessarily want to spend all the time being pregnant. The woman was walking proud. At that point, we kind of thought, OK, well, you know, if we've got a shop, we could use it for that too. So I think that's when we decided we would, you know, fair trade was going to be important for us. But we still had a lot of commitments to the projects we were supporting. Mm. So, you know, up until that point, we'd been buying anything that would sell. Mm. You know, it was the time of Rubik's Cubes. We sold a lot of Rubik's Cubes. And we went, you know, there was some, Martin Grossmith, it wasn't quite that. But anyway, you know, they were down St. Andrew's Squares. They sold a lot of junky kind of toys, but you make quite a lot of money out of those. Uh-huh. So we had to kind of gradually purge ourselves of some of that. And I think, you know, people in the fair trade community looked on us with some wonder as to what we quite were, really. But we took a decision at the board to say, you know, that this was more important than just raising money. We gradually increased the amount of fair trade goods we sold. But, I mean, being out here, you had to draw people out, too. And, I mean, we had a second-hand book cabin, you may remember.
Oh, I loved going in there. Always had this smell as well about it.
Yes.
Go in. And what I liked, too, is digging around the box of tools under the table as well.
Yeah.
It's very tidy, actually.
It wasn't that tidy.
I was wishful thinking.
I'll show you afterwards. We've got a photograph. We've got a couple of photographs in the bedroom, one with the two of our kids sat on the table right at the end reading books. And another one which the door's sort of ajar and you can just see Tom's legs, you know, as he's lying on the floor reading a book.
Brilliant. Yeah.
But yeah, they always want to go and
because we'd come here, come into the cafe, I'd have a quick look and then straight and browse the books, find something, read, and Anne would be browsing round the shop, but and I'd be happy in the
Well, that was exactly it, you know, it was something for the men.
Tools!
And, I mean, when we moved to Gavin's Mill, you know, people came for the first year or so, they said, are you going to have the second hand book?
Brilliant.
So anyway, so yes, I mean, but we needed to attract people here if they were going to come regularly. That's really how we got involved in fair trade. Mm. We started to import, and we thought we could do it, you know, some ourselves. And, you know, we'd find addresses of people to write to, some of whom were, you know, being imported by Tradecraft. Mm. And at a certain point, I think Tradecraft felt a little bit
miffed
or threatened by this. And I was summoned to Tradecraft.
My goodness.
And I sat in a rather small office with Richard Adams and Richard Evans while they told me why they thought this wasn't appropriate. And I said, well, but, you know, you're making such a huge markup on them. This isn't... I think that was naive on my part too. I didn't realise what their overheads were like. They discouraged us from doing some of that. But we had a warehouse in Ayres Lane, down off Stockwell Street.
Okay.
And we were also involved with Christian Aid and the Aina community in Centrepiece. And Centrepiece was a wonderful mixture of things. Mm. It was a sort of non-violent direct action centre with training. Yeah, Helen Stevens, who was a great sort of anti-nuclear protester.
I recognise the name.
She had this idea for Centrepiece. It was a sort of peace centre. And then they said, you know, with the help to pay the rent, would we like to come and run a shop in it? And I think those two aims weren't totally compatible. You know, customers quietly browsing while people were learning how to scream if they were lifted off the demonstration by the police. Didn't always make for complete peace and harmony. But then we had a bit in the warehouse, which was actually right behind this shop. Mm. It's quite a large warehouse. And we ran a small importing business from there. And it never really took off. So eventually, that was all in the 90s, Centrepiece closed. We sort of wrapped up all that. And I just got a chair, and I was kind of felt I had to give a lot of my time, more time to university, so that we kind of pulled out of importing at that point and just carried on with the coach house and our projects from the Balmore Trust. We both was retired at the end of 2002.
Retired from, was it academia?
Or? Yeah, yes. Yeah. Nana was a doctor, and she's working at Stob Hill, and I was at Glasgow doing theology. So I retired right at the end of 2002. But earlier that year, I'd had a letter from Eswatini Swazi Kitchen, because Oxfam had been importing their jams and marmalades and sauces, but they'd just taken the decision to stop all their importing, so all the trading they were doing stopped. So Eswatini lost their UK market. And they wrote to a number of fair trade shops, I think, probably. And I think they also wrote to Trade Grub. I spoke to Liz Cotton, and I spoke to Rachel in the One World Shop, and said, look, if I import some of these jams, are you interested? And they said, yes, I'd take some. I ordered February 2002, and we had absolutely nothing. And I'd completely forgotten about it. And we'd been skiing, and we came back, as was February the following year. Jan in the coach, or no, somebody in the coach, I said, oh, by the way, there's 1,500 jars of jam in your dining room. So I rang up Liz, and her parents came round in their car the next day, and I took them over to the One World Shop. So that was quite nice. I had a nice project. I was writing a book, which I spent quite a lot of time on, but I could... When my coffee breaks, I'd pick up a phone and ring up another One World shop and tell them about these wonderful jams. And it went really well, because it was not so much the jams, but the sauces and the spices. Because fair trade was really quite sweet. I mean, it was chocolates and jams. And Tradecraft, I think, hadn't done Eswatini, because they had their strawberry and their marmalade.
I love their spices and their sauces.
Yeah, well, they're brilliant, and they're kind of interesting, because it's South African Indian recipes. So they're the variations that have been created.
And we wouldn't get them here. Mm. Whereas jams, etc., we might not get all the flavours, but but the sauces, just so different.
Yeah, no, I think, medium curry sauce has been the best.
Has it?
Yeah, and it's so good, you put it in a soup. And anyway, so we sort of did that as a hobby. Again, we had no overhead. We had a little half cellar under the house that we used, and the grandchildren were good at getting in and out and getting the... And then people across the road let their house to a very nice couple. She was Namibian, and they had quite a large barn, which they let us use. And then it got big. And we made something like £50,000 off that one year. We would order a container by then, and we'd ring up all the shops and say, how much do you want? Because it'll be all gone if you don't buy it. And we'd sell most of it by the time it arrived. So we got a warehouse in Twecker, and we had to borrow the forklift truck and the forklift truck driver from a little bakery up the road so we could offload the containers. Yeah. And then Liz, you know, there was questions whether Rainbow Turtle was going to have to move out, and the council gave her these two warehouses, which were more than... So she said, would you like to move in? So that's when we... Yeah, that was 2008, I think.
I think that was very much the heyday of Rainbow Turtle, when, you know, it was much bigger and...
You had the shop next door then, didn't you?
The shop was in Paisley, but it was a five-minute walk from the warehouse.
Yeah. I mean, was it where you still are?
Yeah, we did not move the shop.
No, so I think... But
we did sell a return from the warehouse.
That's right.
Which we don't do now.
Yeah, so, I mean, we were in there together.
Yeah, it was a brilliant setup.
Yeah, and it worked immensely well for us. Yeah. It's remained a real resource for JTS because we couldn't get warehousing at that kind of price.
Yes.
So that was when we moved, and at that moment... I went to, you say there's the miracles, but things happened, there was a meeting in the Scottish Parliament. I was sat next to somebody I didn't know, and he said, do you know there's going to be a Malawi trade fair in the SEC? And they'd been working with the Scottish government to promote Malawi trade, and they'd brought, it was quite a large exhibition, actually. So they brought all sorts of producers over. I didn't know about it, but I went along, and because we were beginning to think we need to diversify, I mean, just having all our eggs in one basket wouldn't be a good idea. And I met Nasfam, who did the rice, but I met a lot of people. And Simon Hess, who was working with Imani Development, who put on this fair, we got talking, and Murdoch, who was Liz Cotton's godfather, I think, who worked for Imani too, and had been working out for Tradecraft in Malawi, was there. And they said, look, you know, we could do a project together, importing 8 new products from Malawi, and you'd do the importing and so on, and we'd do all the admins. So we did, and the great thing for that was that Imani had an office in Malawi, and they took me out, and we did this fantastic tour around Malawi, meeting all these producers, and we went right up to the north of Malawi to see Casper, who were rice farmers, and to see their warehouse. And Tracy Morse, who's now doing sustainability in Strathclyde, but has been part of the Scotland-Malawi partnership, very important part of that. She went up to do a kind of HACCP and health and safety check on that. And I met some of the farmers. And the first farmer I met was... Muslim. He had a wife and 3 or 4 children. And I sat down with him and asked him what he did. And he said he grew enough maize and cassava and vegetables for the family, for their needs. And then he had a couple of acres where he grew rice. And that was his cash crop. So I said, what do you use the money for? And he said, well, for housing, and I've built my mother-in-law a really nice house, and they'd got brick-built houses and tin roofs, and for clothes, and for transport, he had a bicycle, and for education. So we sort of sat, and I said, well, how much do you have to sell to send one child to school for a year? And there was a long conversation with Don. So they all, and I couldn't understand what was being said, but we talked to Nasfam, who were responsible for the sales of all the rice, and they said, they could send us a container. I forget what it was going to cost in those days, but probably 15,000 or something. So we said, well, we really don't have the money to do that, and we've not actually ever sold any rice at all. So they said, fine, we'll just send you a container, and you pay for it as you sell it.
Incredible.
So that was fine, and we had a warehouse. It was great. This was when we started just trading, because I realised at that point that we had to set up something. So on the Christmas Eve, I rang Liz and Liam and Tracy and offered them jobs. I think it took half an hour, and they sort of agreed. First thing was to get this container and get it bagged, and Tracy project managed that. Unbelievably, everything was sort of planned. And we did it. I mean, the container came in at the beginning of January, and there was a fair trade fair in the concert hall at the beginning of fair trade fortnight. Mm. And we were the first people in with the first bag of rice we'd received, set up our stall. And then, so we sold. Yeah. And then we thought, well, how are we going to sell this container? And Liz said, well, why don't we just challenge people to sell 90 kilos? And that, I mean, that idea is still going.
It is.
I mean, I'm going down to Ayr, I think, in the beginning of Fair Trade Fortnight, yes, to talk to St. Mary's, yes, in Ayr. And that really got the engagement with churches and schools. Mm-hmm. That's how we sort of got into the importing side of things. And that relationship, I think, is what's really defined our sort of approach to fair trade. I mean, if you ask what is fair trade and what's the future, there's so many big questions around that, and I've never been completely convinced that you would, well, I've been far from convinced that you could turn the whole of world trade into fair trade. I just don't think that realistic in any kind of way. I mean, there's China and Russia and the Middle East, and, you know, how would you do that? But you can undoubtedly encourage people to think differently about trade, and I think fair trade has actually contributed hugely to ethical consumerism, to encouraging people to think about what they buy and why they buy it. And that's a force for good which has grown, not just in the fair trade world, but outside it. And that's really important. I think, you know, you can put a label on it and try and take it into the supermarkets. Well, it's obviously been done. I mean, there are real problems about that. And I was reading an article the other day which Tracy, she'd been talking to people in Edinburgh. Anyway, it was about ethical labelling and saying that particularly with fair trade, because, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, there's been such a sort of amalgamation of different shops and things that you're now faced with a much bigger partners from the supermarket. They have much more negotiating power.
Yes.
And if you talk to people at the Fair Trade Foundation 10 years ago, they would tell you quietly that, you know, the supermarkets put a lot of, you can't raise the minimum price, we couldn't we couldn't sell it at that price. You know, and if you're dependent on your fair trade sales for your revenues, as the Fair Trade Foundation was, and your big buyers are saying, no, sorry, we can't do that, that's a lot of pressure. You know, I think if you go back to the beginnings of tradecraft, I mean, Richard Adams, you know, he was all about trade justice, and he wanted to challenge people who were just out to make huge profits and exploit people, and he wanted to change the world of trade. And I think, yes, you know, actually, tradecraft and fair trade has challenged and has certainly helped, I mean, the growth of ethical consumerism and to change people's attitudes. And that's a power which is there now and can be galvanised. So that's a real gain. It certainly hasn't taken the teeth out of capitalism, and it's unlikely to do that.
I suppose I see it very much like a pendulum in a way, that at the beginning there was strong support for fair trade, whether it was a label or not, and then the big businesses saw that as a marketing tool, brought it in, and then shifted the goalposts. But in doing that, lost interest in the small producers because they're only interested in profit and quantity, etc. And that allows us back in to reclaim that space again. And so I think that's coming back, that while they are distorting what fair trade means, or, you know, all their other labels that they throw into it, for us it's still really important to concentrate on the producers and what benefits them rather than the profits that the shareholders need. And I think for me it's that voice, and particularly now it's linked in with the environment as well.
I think that's right. And I remember being in a conference down in London, which Fair Trade Foundation, this was way back, and one of the speakers said, look, if you guys don't get onto, you know, take seriously the whole environmental challenge, you will be sidelined. And I think there's been a danger that it's become, you know, went at its height, where what was the true mark of fair trade was that it had a fair trade label on it. And we used to have difficulty because Eswatini didn't. And most people accept, you know, understood perfectly well that this was a valid kind of form of fair trade. But you would get the odd purist who just would not buy it.
I think that's where the story helps. If you can tell the story, that's what people connect to.
Yes, exactly. And there are farmers do now have a fair trade. They're WFTO certified. And we got a grant from the Scottish Government. It cost over £30,000 to get there. Merrow, I think, are just doing it themselves, and it'll cost very little. But for most of the time, they weren't. But the work we've done with the farmers has opened our eyes to what the potential is and the contribution they can make and the ways that you can work with them, and has really developed an extremely rich kind of partnership. And has, certainly opened up my eyes to the plight of smallholder farmers, and that's what I've learned over the last 20-odd years. It's not so much that since 2008, the last 14, 15 years. What I hadn't appreciated was that something like 75% of the population of sub-Saharan Africa are subsistence farmers, and many of whom don't grow enough food to get through till the next harvest. So they're the people who are most likely to go to bed hungry in the world. They're also the people who are suffering very severely from climate change. If that gets worse, the number of fragile states in Africa will grow and grow and grow. And, you know, the problems we're seeing in the Channel or in the Mediterranean will get dramatically worse.
Yes.
And yet, you talk to people in the aid agencies and they're aware of it. I remember overhearing a terrible conversation where they were talking about the difficulty of, do you just rescue the ones who are coming down the river and about to go over the waterfall? Or do you lead them to go over the waterfall and try and do something with the people further upstream? And you have to be confronted with those kinds of choices.
You can't make a choice like that.
That's terrible.
Yeah, you've got to do both.
Yeah, well, you have, yeah, but you have limited resources, and we've just cut back on it, even more limited.
Yeah.
I mean, what's really focused my attention is how you can actually work with farmers and how you can try and get them beyond the state of just being subsistence farmers. And I heard a very interesting chat from a DFID person down in London. Oh, I think they produced a report about 2014 on smallholder farmer development. Mm. And very simply, she was saying, we have to, these people have got to grow and they've got to develop. Mm. And there will be some people who all you can do with at the moment is just help them to cling on. But there are other farmers who can step up and they can turn their subsistence farms into small businesses and help their families and their communities to grow. And there will be others who will step out and start their own little businesses around their farms and will also help the community to grow, and the money that they're raising from their farms will. I think that's what's happened in very broad terms to our relationship with the rice farmers in Malawi. There were a number, because they have this very good relationship within NASFAM and they're well organised, they have training programmes. So there are already farmers who are stepping up, but when we first met them, I think there would be probably less than 2,000 members of CASFA up in the North Rice Farmers. But as they've seen, as others have seen, the benefit of growing rice and being able to get cash. I mean, at one point, their membership had gone up to about 7,000. And at that point, they said, we can't cope with that. So I think they're now about 6, somewhere in that region. But these are people who have grown their businesses. We had a lot of very good support from the Scottish Government, and I don't think this can work without government support. But they gave us quite a large grant, and we did seed multiplication. So they bought seed from the Seed Institute, and they grew it under supervision and produced certified seed. And they managed to complete a second cycle without traditional support. And that's given them much better quality seed and much better yields.
Mm.
And then we had money for ox carts, which is what farms here in the 1930s were staple kind of implement for them. So it means they can get food to their cattle if they've got cattle. It means they can ship bricks if they're building houses. They can run a local kind of freight service for their community. I mean, nearly 5 years since I was there because of COVID and one thing, but it was noticeable when you went round the farmyards that they were just more like your picture book farmyards. they had more animals in the farmyards. Yeah. They had things just felt more prosperous. And subsequently, there are two groups of women who are trying to set up businesses. We'll see how that goes. Both groups want to do briquette making.
Oh, yes.
You can use rice husk to produce briquettes. They're not quite there yet. But that would obviously be a much better thing than going up in the hills and chopping down trees, which is now officially illegal anyway.
Yes.
And then the Howard, who was for quite a while the chair of CASFA, the Farmers Association, he's got a training centre and they've been doing training courses for sewing and carpentry and welding. So they've just finished they've had their first training things, and they're now beginning to look for finance to develop those businesses. Mm. So that model of sort of hanging in, stepping up and stepping out is actually working really very nicely there. And you could see how, you know, if there was more encouragement for that kind of development, which is sort of organic and grows out of a...
Yeah. And it's not somebody coming in and... imposing a model that it's one that comes from them.
Yeah, and what's nice about it, I mean, Howard in particular has been over here a lot, and he's made friends over here too. Mm. So, I mean, he's got a friend down in Dumfries who has did a degree in agricultural development and it's very hands-on. So he's had Howard over, taught him welding skills. There's a small organisation in Dundee, Banana Box, which ships stuff out to Malawi. So, you know, we're shipping out tools to them.
Brilliant.
So that they, hopefully, there's a NGO which is looking to build up Howard's training centre and finance courses. And that encouraged growth of small businesses. It'll help bring that economy up. And there've been local markets for farmers. And if you could show how that market can work, then you would hope you could get governments to invest in it. The problem we have above all is working capital. We just got orders from the Central England Co-op for rice. So we actually ordered 4 containers this summer, which is over £100,000 worth. Well, we've had to pay for it now. I mean, it's arrived, but we had to pay half of it up front. That's a lot of capital. If you went on the open market to try and get loans for that, I have once asked, and I was told, well, then, frankly, we prefer to give loans to Germany and France, not to Malawi, it's too risky. If we were to even consider it, the interest rates would be way. But even if we went to shared interest, they would be really quite high. Mm. It's not. So by the time you've paid that up front, and by the time you've paid to get your rice out, and it's a landlocked country, so you've got to get it out through Mozambique, which is not the most friendly environment, customs-wise, and then ship it round. It's very expensive. And that's all money you've got to lay out before you can even begin to sell it. That's a kind of major hurdle, really, is finance. Up till now, we've been considerably helped by Social Investment Scotland.
Okay.
And their loans are certainly less than shared interest, actually, but we've never got very far down that road. But that's my belief that they would have. But they were still 6 or 7%, you know, when other loans would have been maybe 2 or 3. That's because they're high-risk loans. There's a great reluctance, I think, on the part of government to fund what they see as commercial projects. And what you really need is some sort of... But, I mean, they do private-public financing initiatives. Yeah. If they want to, they will. But neoliberal economics sort of doesn't approve of the government funding the competition. Yeah. There is still a great belief, I think, in the one side of the development world that what you need to do to feed Africa is to set up large plantations and bring in international business. What would happen to the people who are on those farms at the moment? It's hard to say. They would just flock to cities where there's no work.
So come to my final question, really, and it's more about what's next for you. I mean, for someone who's sort of retired so many different times, it seems daft, but I don't see you stopping. And so I'm sure you've got other ideas still.
you know, we moved the coach house, so the shop we set up, we moved that to Gavin's Mill, original water mill, and that was actually nearly 6 years ago now. Mm. I go from here to a meeting to look at our business plan or whatever, our financial plan for next year, and that's quite a challenge in itself. I stepped back from, I was chair of both the business and the trust which runs it, but I stepped back from that this year, but there's still enough work to doing, and I'm enjoying just buying the books for that and the cards, and just, I mean, I'd be very happy just to do that. JTS will also continue to provide challenges and opportunities. I'm enjoying being less involved, less responsible, having less nights where I'm trying to think about how getting out of jail and just doing things that I can enjoy doing. But I do want, actually, I just want to do some more reading and writing. Mm. I'm pretty sure that doesn't mean writing a big book or anything like that. But I'm on an editorial team for an old kind of more popular theological journal. Yes, I mean, this book I was talking about, Christian Buddhist commentary, or Christian commentary on the Buddhist text. That's one of the books I'm reviewing. I've just reviewed a book on the peace process in South Africa, which is, well, you should come, actually. Liz Carmichael, who wrote it, is giving a talk on Valentine's Day in Gavin's Mill about the peace process in South Africa, which ran between Mandela's release and the elections. Now, everyone knows about Truth and Reconciliation Committee, but there was a National Peace Accord signed up in 91, and they then set up 260 local peace committees, which were standing between Zulus and ANC people, who were not at all friendly towards each other, and trained something like 20,000 monitors for the election, without which I think the election would not have run smoothly. Mm. Nobody's ever talked about this. Mm. So she took us around Alexandra Township when there was a little war going on there. She was chair of their peace committee. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing I really enjoy doing, because I've written a review about it, and she's now coming up to Scotland, and she's going to talk to St Mary's, she's talking to Gavin's Mill, and she'll talk to the peace studies people in Edinburgh. I mean, she organised that. I mean, she's been all around universities in South Africa with this book. It's a major book, and she's documented it in great detail, and it is just fascinating how that process worked. Yes, I do want to read and write more. We'll see what happens.
Well, I really appreciate this time with you. It's been it's been really interesting, and there's so much I've wanted to know about what you've done before, and so it's good to have that opportunity to hear the story
from you. I mean, it's nice to remember these
indeed. And it's important to remember, I think, you know, and to celebrate them. So thank you very much, and hope is that this is going to be out in time for Fair Trade Fortnight. I'm also going to be interviewing Mary Popple in a new feature. I'm going to talk to her tomorrow on the phone. This one I'm planning to have ready for Fair Trade Fortnight. So thank you very much.
Lovely, Colin. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
My thanks again to John Riches for sitting down for so long with me to be interviewed. He's been an interesting person to listen to, with much to say about fair trade. And I was really fortunate to have been able to capture a few of his insights. My next episode, that I plan to have out in a few weeks' time, is an interview with Mary Popple, the current chair of JTS, who had the unenviable task of filling John's shoes. So until then, cheerio. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We believe that it is by telling people's stories that our customers connect with those producers who provide our quality and tasty products that we sell in our Paisley shop. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and share it so that others may listen to it as well. Most importantly, spread the word! A wee thank you to Patrick Quinn, who created the music accompanying the podcast. It's a delightful piece called Colm's Path to Trading Fairly and reminds me of the music that accompanied the TV series All Creatures Great and Small. Feel free to listen, sit back and enjoy.